Welcome everybody to Mike TV episode 24, in which we will be discussing HBO's Watchmen season 1 episode 4, entitled If You Don't Like My Story, Write Your Own. My name is Lisa and joining me is Dean. Hi Dean.
Hey Lisa, how's it going today?
It's great. So excited to talk about yet another Watchmen masterpiece.
Oh, yeah, this continues to stay a good show and keeps adding to the mystery, which, you know, now we're what, one episode? This next one will be the mid-episode, right? Episode 5, so.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a 9-episode series.
Right, so we're at that balance point, so hopefully we're getting toward the peak, and now we're going to start closing things up here in the next few episodes, and they don't save it all to the very last one.
I have some notes for the end about what I've heard about episodes coming up. Nothing too exciting, but we'll save them for the end, so it's a little tease for everybody. So this title of this episode, If You Don't Like My Story, Write Your Own, of course, immediately makes me think, you know, and I'm sure others have said this too, this is not an original thought, this is Damon Lindelof kind of giving the middle finger to the Watchmen fanboys or the people who are purists.
Yeah, maybe a little bit, telling them if they don't want to watch it, then they're free to go write their own fanfic or something like that, or keep reading the original material over and over again and never have it changed throughout the rest of their life.
Yeah, do you think it's a little dig at Alan Moore?
I think it's a dig straight at Tim Andrews for not wanting to watch this show.
He's watching it now, though.
I know.
He may not have all of his facts straight, but he's watching it.
Yeah, he'd understand it a lot more if he listened to our 17-hour episode podcast every week.
Yes, I hear we're thorough. We're very thorough. I'm happy to be compared to Maude Lebowski. She's one of my all-time heroes, so why not? Sure. All right. Also, this title, there is another little Easter egg for this episode title in the show. We'll talk about it when we get there, but I definitely think this was a Lindelof dig. Has to be, right?
Probably. Well, I mean, you know, the Watchmen show is supposed to be a dig at other superhero properties, but probably also a little bit of dig at the source material, or not the source material, but the people who didn't want this to be a thing.
The naysayers.
Yes, yeah. the in 2019, what we call the haters.
The haters, thank you. They're canceled. All right, show opens with a great 80s song that we all loved in the 80s, Islands in the Stream, sung by Kenny Rogers and Dolly Parton. Oh, it's such a great song. This is a montage of a couple. We have not seen this couple before. We do come to learn this is kind of in the past. This is a few years back, I guess. They're on a farm selling eggs. I love the egg theme that continues to carry through all of these episodes. The title screen for Watchmen is done in egg yolks in this one. It's just fun. Anyway, Lady True shows up at their door. Oh, we get the introduction of Lady True. I just love her. Yet another strong female lead in this show. I am thrilled for this character.
Yeah, you know, I thought about... especially toward later in the episode when the three leading women are together in the episode, I had this thought of just, I had the thought of, man, this is cool. They have like these three really strong women roles in this. And then I had the thought of like, and they didn't need to tell me that, hey, don't forget there are three strong leading ladies in this show. You know, like they do it without clobbering it over your head, which I think too many shows do nowadays is they really push into like, you know, if a character comes in, they'll say, you know, hey, this is so-and-so, da-da-da, and he's gay, you know, and, oh, and she's a black lesbian, and, like, they got to really push, like, what their personal traits are, so you know that they're a minority of some sort. But this is just, we got these people, they're characters, and they're awesome, and they kind of happen to be women, like, and women of three different ethnicities and of different ages, and so it's really they're doing it the right way of just telling a good story that just happens to have women at the center of it.
Yeah, and they're all three really smart women, too, and all have different smart or intelligent characteristics, you know?
They're three completely different characters.
Yeah, it's fully formed. Lady True is on the screen fully formed, and this actress is fantastic. So great casting, too. We could talk a little bit about this week's Radio Labyrinth and the discussion they had over Regina King.
I don't want to get you worked up.
Oh, man, I have to disagree with you, Steph, if you're listening. Steph, come on.
Yeah,
Regina King is perfect in this role.
Next Although, time you go walking with Lisa, she's going to push you into the woods.
You know what? You know what? My husband said who else would be good casting as Sister Knight? And I love this. Ruth Negga.
Yeah, that, I actually would like that.
Yeah, yeah, I thought that was really good. But, you know, this is Lindelof, and of course he's got to do more with Regina King. She was so great in The Leftovers. You know, it was the two of them working together. He just writes for Regina King perfectly. Anyway, don't get me on tear. We're still at the beginning of this show, for goodness sakes. So Lady True shows up, introduces herself. We learn this couple, their name, they're Mr. and Mrs. Clark. As she comes in and they do a little exposition saying, of course, she's the billionaire who's building that big clock down the road. And she corrects them saying she's the trillionaire. And it's actually more than just a big clock. So we know this is that kind of the beginning stages of the big, is it called the Watchtower?
The Millennium Clock.
Millennium Clock. Where am I getting Watchtower? Goodness gracious. Millennium Clock. So yeah, this is how we know it's the past. She pulls out this great, you know, giant timer, a la Wizard of Oz, gives herself 3 minutes and says she wants to buy their house and the 40 acres. They say it's not for sale. And not to worry, she says she's got this advanced pharma and biotech background and technology, and then she gets extremely mad, saying it's bullshit that the fact that the Mrs. Clark has unviable eggs, and so she says, "Not to worry, I've made you a baby," in anticipation of this negotiation, and she delivers them their son, who is actually biologically their son, and she says she'll also give them $5 million to cover their relocation costs and, you know, all of the baby's education.
Diapers and stuff. Yeah,
yeah, it's quite an offer. They're quite taken. Lady True also makes a joke about destroying the baby if they don't sign the paperwork, and that was kind of funny. And then she's like, just kidding. I'll just give them to another family. And, you know, maybe she wasn't kidding there with what we learned later on. This is just such an interesting dialogue here. But, of course, they sign the paperwork just in time. And then something comes crashing down from space onto their property, and Lady True proclaims it as hers. And the camera pans over the land, and we get the title screen on the land and what seems to be the passage of time.
Yeah, she gets she gives them an offer they can't refuse, you know, straight up, like, and yeah, she kind of jokes about destroying the baby, but immediately is like, oh, I'm just kidding, I'll give it to a new home, and then she'll never know where she's from, like, just like, she'll never know you, and then, she smartly, you want to hold the baby, like, you know, that's the hook, gets them to hold the baby. Once you take the baby, you can't put it down, so.
She's sweet, but also has this, like, cruel underbelly.
Oh, yeah, she seemed, But until she brought the baby out, I almost kept thinking, like, she's going to end up killing both these people before the scene's over. She did have that just, you could see the darkness behind her, or that she's definitely has some, I don't know, there's some ill intent behind her.
Yeah, for sure. And she definitely knew something was going to come crashing on their property that she wanted. So she was, this was all part of the plan. Now, $5 million in exchange for an egg farm. I mean, they should have taken that with or without the baby.
Yeah. And my thing is, why didn't
that?
If she knew this thing was coming, why didn't she come the day before? Why'd she cut it so close?
Yeah, 3 minutes.
So what do you think it was that crashed down?
I'm sure it's related to Vite.
Well, Vite or Manhattan, right? It's got to be one of the two.
Yeah. I definitely think it's related to the Vite stuff that we get later on. So we can, you know, let's kind of talk about how these two kind of parallel when we get.
Yeah, I did hear on something else that they had thought, or they'd read something that this actually is supposed to be taking place concurrently with the series right now. It's not in the past.
Oh.
Yeah, like, so I don't know. Maybe they happened to see something, or maybe it didn't, but what I'd heard is that, because I'd assumed it was in the past too, but
well,
she doesn't look much different than she does later on.
True, but also, well, we know it's the passage of time because she hasn't built the Millennium Tower yet, and now it's been built. So
yeah, that's what I kind of assumed too, the way they mentioned that.
But also, wherever Vi is, and I think it's pretty safe to say he's not on Earth. I actually think the moon. But so time is passing differently there. What could constitute as a day on Earth could be a year
for him. A year or something, yeah. That's possible.
So it's probably a made-up place. Like, he's not in a real... He's in his own Valerium or whatever they call the...
Vivarium.
Vivarium, yeah. So, all right. The Vi stuff was truly crazy and great.
Yes.
So I clearly want to jump to that.
Yeah.
All right, we'll get there. So we see, and so the passage of time, and Angela is now back at her bakery. She's cleaning up all of the evidence of Will. She's dismantling the wheelchair. She accidentally burns that note as she's listening to a voice message on her answering machine that says they've got more information awaiting her at the Greenwood Cultural Center. So I love this part, too. She gets all in her Sister Night clothes, and then we see her outside of the Greenwood Cultural Center calling into the police station about a break-in, and then she herself is the one breaking in. So that was a great way to elude the rest of the police from coming. And then she's back at the Henry Louis Gates machine and says she needs to see her family tree. And I love this. The machine produces an acorn for her to go and plant in the ancestry room. That was a great little, if you caught that there on the room as she's entering in the little marquee. She drops the acorn into a cylinder and we get this hologram tree that grows and it's announced as her family tree. It has a new arm for her father's side. And she learns about her great-grandparents and sees a little hologram of little Will, little cutie pie that he is. And there's this great visual of her face lining up with his. And she starts having this emotional speech about how now she knows where she came from. And then it ends with, so wherever you are, leave me the fuck alone. And then that's when we hear the car crash outside on the ground.
Yeah, do you think there's going to, are we going to find importance with her parents, or do you think that there's not going to be a ton of importance? Because obviously she was born in Vietnam.
We learn about her parents and stuff, a little bit more about that this episode, and I do think it's going to be important, yes.
So I'm wondering if, because based on her age, she was probably born in the 70s, right? Like the... So yeah. I'm wondering if maybe her dad was, if we're find out he was a soldier maybe in the Vietnam War, and that's why he was over there.
Ooh, yeah, that makes sense. And probably a black soldier.
And I wonder if we'll find out maybe I'm kind of, well, see, that's the thing, though. Because she's so much, or at least she seems so much younger than Lori. Because I'm wondering if he was over there, if maybe we would, if that would be a way to somehow, if a flashback, we could, he knew the comedian or had a run-in with the comedian over there.
Or even Dr. Manhattan.
Or even Dr. Manhattan.
That's good. I believe her parents' death was probably tied to that. I think we'll learn that. And what else was I going to say about this? Well, anyway, we'll move on because I don't remember. So I do love this, that the car crashing takes place, you know, right outside of where she's at. So she runs out and we get that scene where we left off with the last episode with Lori laughing. And she quickly snaps out of that laughing mode when she hears Angela approaching and she turns and pulls a gun on her very fast. So we know Lori is she's no slouch, clearly. We knew that already, though. And then Angela, the car alarm is going off. And so Angela very quickly lets on that this is her car because she knows where the secret key is hidden.
Right.
She turns off the alarm and gets in the car, checks the glove box, doesn't pull the pills out yet, but we do see the pills are in the glove box, Will's pills. Oh, I remember what I was going to say. In the previous scene, do you think there was significance in that note getting burned? The note that's followed
the
past few episodes? I almost think it was a way of saying the note has served its purpose. We don't need to worry about the note anymore.
I kind of thought the same. I feel like even if we get mentioned, it'll almost be like when she sees Will again at some point, he'll be like, well, don't you have that? Didn't you read the thing on the letter? And she'll be like, oh, it burned. He'll be like, oh, okay.
Yeah, this note that I've had all my life that I've carried is the only thing my father gave me.
Yeah, right.
And it just carelessly burned. You know, I guess, but the totem to Will now are the pills. It was the note, now it's the pills.
Yeah, and he left it specifically for her, so.
Mm-hmm. But, yeah, I kind of sad to see that note burn. Anyway, I do love this, Lori tells Angela that she seems to have everything under control, so she just decides she's going to, you know,
yeah.
Out. But I love that she says, cool costume, by the way.
Yeah. Yeah, just she another dig of just like, you guys look ridiculous, but whatever, cool.
Yeah. She also says something about how the car fell out of the sky and she doesn't joke about things falling out of the sky.
Yeah. Well, and she also makes a very pointed remark to make, or she makes sure to say, Angela. She like calls her Angela.
Yeah.
And it's funny because at that point, Angela had already taken off her mask. So mm-hmm. It's like she already knows that she knows who she is. But even when she says her name as opposed to Sister Knight, Angela's face, you can kind of tell, is just still, she doesn't like that she's not anonymous anymore as this character.
Oh, yeah. She doesn't like being outed.
Right.
But does she know that she knows that she knows she knows?
I guess we'll never know.
Were you a Friends fan?
Yes.
So that's a Friends reference.
My wife has consistently watched Friends for the past however many years it's been on, or since it's been on.
You know, mostly it's stupid, but that episode I just love. They don't know we know they know. It's so great. It's just anything with Lisa Kudrow. Okay. So Angela gets back to her home, finds the little girl. This is, of course, still the same day as the funeral. This is the night of the funeral.
Right.
So, of course, the kids are traumatized. Who wouldn't be? So she gets home. The little girls are in bed with Cal, so she goes to sleep in Topher's room in his bottom bunk of his bunk bed. I love this scene. It was so sweet. He asks her if she was scared when the bomb started beeping and she saved everybody, and she says, yeah, she was, and she still is a little bit. And then he sweetly hands her this stuffed animal. And I know this is a stuffed animal that's an Ozymandias creature from the comic books, but I've already forgotten its name. Do you have some background on that toy?
Like supposed to be like his lynx, like the Bobastis one?
Yeah.
No, it's not. I think you maybe get that from the Watchmen Watch? Podcast. I know they thought that might be what it was, but I watched it again. It's just this like rabbit thing with giant ears. I don't think it's anything. I don't know.
I think it is. I think I've heard it. I've heard it on a few different places.
It didn't look like a big giant cat.
Well, anyway, it was cute, and that was a sweet scene. And I think it's pretty obvious that Topher knows also that she's
not
a retired cop. Opening a bakery. He's pretty hip to that.
He's very knowledgeable. I know, I guess kind of a common theory, not a theory even, but like the big kind of overarching mystery that everyone wants to know is who is Dr. Manhattan, you know? And Cal gives hints that he could be possibly Dr. Manhattan. Topher gives hints, especially when he was playing with the toys and was making the same castle as Dr. Manhattan. There's the I know it's like his little light machine, but his whole room is that blue glow when she goes in there. So I don't know. He's a weird kid for sure. Or he's at least very aware of everything.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot of weird kids in this episode in particular. We get probably more on the weirdest kid, so we'll get to her. All right. So the next morning over breakfast, the kids are having an argument at the table whether Uncle Judd is in heaven. The littlest girl, I think that's Emma is the littlest one. It's Rosie and Emma. I don't know which one. But the littlest one, she's so stinking cute, screams out, Uncle Judd didn't go to heaven. They're saying Uncle Judd didn't go to heaven when he blowed up.
Yeah, like when he blowed up.
It's so adorable. And then Cal very rationally sits down and explains to them the life cycle and how you're nowhere before you're born, and then when you're dead, you're nowhere again.
Yeah, just the worst parenting speech I've ever heard in my life. Even if that's what you believe, that kid, you at least pretend.
I think you could have given a little bit more there.
Yeah,
I think,
yeah,
he was so, yeah. And even Angela, who is pretty tough herself, was even a little taken back about that. Like, that's all?
Yeah, yeah. Although I did like immediately, he was like, who wants waffles?
Yeah.
And then everyone's just like, yay!
Yeah. Forget Uncle Judd that he blowed up.
Yeah, right? It's like she like goes from her face being like, he's nowhere to waffles!
Mm-hmm. Should say that that scene opened again with more eggs as he's making the waffles, that he's cracking eggs in a bowl. Love that. All right. Angela, in her civvies, goes to visit LG, and he's also not in costume, and he lives in this cool bunker home thing, this weird futuristic underground. Clearly, this is his bunker home. There's nothing else to say about it. Inside, we see that he's been studying the Squid Falls. He's got pictures, like he's got a dark room and development and pictures of the squid hanging all over. He seems somewhat sympathetic to the squid's plight. Angela calls him weird, and he remarks that surely she must see the hypocrisy of that statement.
Yes.
Oh, God, I just love him.
Yeah,
he's
great. He's my favorite character by far.
I don't know that he's my favorite. There's a lot of favorites in this show, but he is definitely up there. Every scene, he is just fabulous.
His dialogue is just, if he reads his dialogue word for word as far as it's written, or if he comes up with some of these sayings himself, but I just love the way that he talks around what he's, he doesn't just directly say anything. It's always kind of these weird, like, sideways comments to get to what he's trying to say to somebody, and I just love the way he turns phrases in this show.
Yeah, especially here, this little conversation they have. Angela gives him the pills and says she wants his ex to find out what the pills are. And he does say something about emphasis on X. And then he says, there's a lab at the precinct, and she says she wants them examined somewhere other than the precinct. And he asks if this has to do with their beloved chief of police. And then she says, he was a racist. And his reply was so great. He says he's a white man living in Oklahoma, very matter-of-factly, which, by the way, so is he.
Right.
So,
do you think? I think that was just his way of, because she kind of said, "Did you know he was a racist?" And when he says, I think that's kind of his way of saying that most people just assume any white man who grew up in Tulsa, Oklahoma, at least if they're not necessarily a racist, was probably raised with at least
exposed
some
to
of
it.
Yes, exactly. Most we deal with that right now, right? Living in Georgia.
Sure.
People that grew up in Georgia, especially if you grew up in your, in the 70s or even the 80s, you were around just a different culture back then, even if you don't believe that now. I'm from Kentucky, and I always remember my grandmother was, I wouldn't think was a racist, but her favorite golfer before she died was Tiger Woods, and but she always referred to him as, is my colored boy on TV this week? Like she called him that. And, that's just how she talked because she grew up through early America.
I mean, there's nothing we can do about the past and about our heritage, So to me, it's kind of like it is what it is. We can only break that cycle and choose not to continue that. But beating people up who are our age and white and living in America in the South now, we can't control what happened with our families.
Yeah, but you can't change what happened.
We're not that way. We can't help that we were exposed. It doesn't mean that we're going to continue those patterns.
Right.
And it just seems for people to say, racial things are worse now than they ever were, just seems crazy. But so anyway, so LG makes a good point, though, you know, that, yeah, he just very matter-of-factly, he was a white man, grew up in Oklahoma.
Right.
And then she pulls the robes that she stole from Judd's closet and hands them to him. And he says they're old school, maybe belonged to his grandfather, maybe it was just a keepsake. But he does agree to hold on to them so that the FBI lady won't find it. And then he says that lady is extremely weird. I do love it. He says, is this so the FBI lady won't find it? And you don't want the FBI lady to find the pills either.
Right, yeah.
And that lady is extreme. Be careful of her. She's extremely weird.
Yeah. I like that he does point out, like, on the show at this point that these are old robes. And we talked about that a little bit the other week with the PDpedia files talking about Judd's whole family tree basically being police officers in Tulsa. And we thought that maybe the grandfather possibly could have been the sheriff or in the police department during those 1921 riots. So this is a little bit more of a direct, you know, almost confirmation of that, or at least leading us closer to that conclusion.
Yeah. Yeah. It's strange that Angela doesn't say, no, I think they're a little bit more than just a keepsake. He had them presented in a hidden closet, displayed in all their finery on a bust. You know, if it was just a keepsake, you throw them in a, you know, like one of those like dust things that you suck all the air out and throw under your bed or whatever.
Those vacuum bag things.
Well, that's what you do if it's just a keepsake. So I don't know. He clearly was. Yeah, he had some pride there.
Yeah, it's also interesting to me that even if Angela does feel that this is something, she still knows that, or at least she still believes that their relationship was authentic enough that she's not just like, you know, she didn't just give it to Lori. She didn't just tell her, oh, yeah, this guy did have some skeletons in his closet, literally, and you know and we need to find out what's going on with him. She wants to figure out this mystery because she wants to make sure that he's not railroaded if that's not the case, right? And I think she doesn't want to believe that he was a bad guy.
Right Agree.
And even agree. even with LG, she completely trusts him with this information, and you know, and she trusts him enough that he's obviously a prepper with his bunker. And so, and if you didn't realize he was working for the police, he seems and looks the most racist out of everybody on the show with his, you know, Fu Manchu mustache. And especially when he has a hat on over with his hair scraggly out on, you know, the sides and everything, he looks like the most kind of hillbilly-ish type guy, but she trusts them, so it is.
Well, they have
it
a
is
great
blurring the line still.
They have a great mutual trust, you know, because it's evident just in this one little scene. They're seeing each other completely unmasked.
Right.
He's letting her into his personal bunker, his clearly secret lair,
right,
you know, and she's just down there like she's been down there plenty of times before. So, I love their friendship.
Yeah.
But, okay, so should we move on to what could be construed as a controversial scene, to say the least, but one of what I would think is one of my favorite scenes of the episode. Let's hear if it's yours. So Angela goes and puts back on, this is in and out of this Sister Night gear, but she gets back into Sister Night gear, and then we see she's disposing of the duffel bag that has the wheelchair parts. And she's at some sort of like trash facility. She just drops it over a bridge onto a moving truck. And she turns around and sees a tall, slender man in a silver, what can only be described as like a silver, like scuba diving suit. He's wearing goggles and he's watching her from across the street. She has the same exact reaction that I do, which is to just say, what the fuck? And then she begins chasing him. And there's that great, brilliant Trent Reznor score behind them as this chase scene is going on. It's fantastic, as always. Yeah, I love it so much. He leads her on quite a chase, too. They're both fast, but he manages to stay just a few steps ahead of her.
Would you say he keeps slipping away from her?
Yeah. He's wearing this utility belt around his waist. It's his only gear other than his goggles. And it's filled with, like squirt bottles. And he starts to pull the bottles out of the, as he's running, he's pulling the bottles out of the belt, spraying himself down with this. And then he rips the belt off and then slides down a drain storm. And to which Sister Knight again screams, "What the fuck?" Which is exactly what I put, which is exactly what all of the audience was saying. Now, yes, I've heard some people hated this and some people loved it.
I thought it was fantastic. I referred to him as Slider Man.
Well, Red Scare gives him Lube Man, so yeah. I'm stick with Lube Man.
I just thought he looked like a silver Spider-Man anyway, and so, that's what I keep. That's what I'm trying to get trending on Twitter is hashtag Slider Man.
He looks like the kid from A Christmas Story when they're standing in line to see Santa, and that kid is in front of them bugging the shit out of Ralphie. And saying, I like Wizard of Oz, whatever he's saying. And he's got this like goofy goggles.
Yeah.
If you look at his face, that's what the guy looked like in the face. But he's tall and thin. And
I
immediately thought Petey. I mean, I don't know that this is a big revelation. I think it's going to be Petey. I don't think they're trying to hide that it's
Petey. I don't. That's what everyone wants to. I think everyone like is going toward that only because he's built like Petey. But I'm under the camp that we never see him again. I think this was just a way of like showing like, hey, don't forget there's weird ass superheroes running around mm-hmm. this world. And this happens to be one of them.
Yeah. But one to be so directly planted and on watching Angela, I don't think it's random.
I don't know. I kind of hope that like, if we do ever see anything, it's almost just like, there's a crime scene and you find out he was killed trying to stop a crime or something like that. And you never find, and he just, I kind of don't want him to be part of the story. Cause it's just, I like it better when it's just this kind of weird out there part of the world.
I love that too, but that it'll drive the audience. The majority of the audience will go crazy if we don't learn this man's identity.
I thought for sure, I did not expect him to slip into that sewer grate. I thought he was going to set himself on fire.
I did too.
Not even kill himself, but I thought maybe that suit was like a flame retardant thing and he was going to end up being like, this world's human torch or something. And he was going to set himself on fire and then try to fight her, which would have been awesome. But.
Well, clearly none of the other, her other fellow cops that she shares this information with seem too concerned about him.
No, not at all. Well, because the new boss isn't concerned with this.
Yeah, exactly. So heading into the police station, Sister Knight does have that quick run-in with Senator Keene. And Senator Keene immediately lets on that he knows who she is. He says, "Hello, Angela." Again, she takes her back, even though you could see it in her eyes.
Yeah.
That she, great face acting, Regina King, but you can see it in her eyes that she's already taken back when he says that. He says, thanks for saving his life at the funeral. And she says, and then he also says that he probably shouldn't have been there because he's too high profile and knows there's a target on his back. She says she tells him, try not to get kidnapped. And then she takes the belt. She does pick up the belt, I should say, from this greasy man. She has this belt in hand. She takes it over to Pirate Jenny and Red Scare. And they say, well, was he wearing a Rorschach mask? Was he saying TikTok?
Yeah,
then it probably doesn't matter. The new boss isn't going to care about your lube man, is what Red Scare says. To which Angela says, new boss. And, Lori has taken over Judd's office. Of course, Angela is not happy about that.
No, more foil between the two of them.
Oof. These two need to team up, not be at each other's throats. Maybe they're a little more teamed up by the end of this episode. Hard to say. Well, probably they're not, actually, based on that conversation Lori and Cal have. But, okay, we'll get there. So this is the part of the show that this is, from this point on, I've watched it three times because it was just full steam ahead. I loved every scene from here on out. So this scene between the two of them in Judd's office is great. Lori says that they dusted that car and found her family's prints all over them, of course, but also a set of mystery prints, which of course could belong to a friend, but Angela doesn't strike her as the kind of person who has friends. And I love Lori, just smart ass, love her. She reveals that she set the fingerprints to Quantico, and they match someone in Quantico's database who was a cop in the 40s and 50s in New York City by the name of William Reeves. Dun, dun, dun. But of course, he would be over 100 years old by now. And don't you know that men who are over 100 years old tend to get around in wheelchairs? So not getting anything over on this Lori, Blake.
Yeah, I don't completely, because I know how Lindelof tends to work, but I do keep getting the feeling creeping up in the back of my head of, will you two just drop the bitchy bullshit and just talk to each other about what you both actually know?
Yeah.
Cause Lori, I think, is trying to, without just saying it, she's basically knows everything. Yeah. I think she probably knows he's related to, Angela.
Yeah.
I mean, if she knows everything else, why wouldn't that already be in their database? If they, you know, if the cultural center knows it, surely the FBI knows it.
Absolutely.
And I think that's what she's been trying to tell Angela from the beginning is, I know everything
and
about
Angela
you.
And should
already.
Be smart enough to figure that out.
And I can't understand what her, I'm trying to figure out what her, and I think Cal even questions this about her later, is what is it you're trying to hide and why are you trying to hide it? Maybe this lady's just trying to help you.
Yeah. And Angela's just stubborn. You know what? She's just stubborn for the sake of being stubborn.
But I can't tell if she's worried that she'll be implemented, even though she knows she didn't do anything, or if she worries about Will for some reason, even though she shouldn't, or if she's so worried about Judd's reputation and what she thought of him being destroyed that she wants to find out first so that she can either, and I don't know what she would do if she finds out the truth. Will she try to hide it? Will she try to, you know, say no, that's not true and figure out something else? It's hard to really.
Her motives are unclear.
What her motives are. Mm-hmm. And I don't think she knows really what her motives are.
Hmm. In a way, it makes her an unreliable narrator, right? Because she could just completely continue to evolve and change, which is what Will wants. This, the whole thing too about Will wants her to figure this out. She has to figure it out for herself.
Yeah.
Like she has to, you have to have the journey to fully experience the, the reward.
Yeah.
Very Lord of the Rings. All right. So, men can get around in wheelchairs. So they're interrupted, though, by this revelation of Lori definitely letting her know how much she knows without saying, I know. They're interrupted as Petey comes in and whispers some news, and Lori says, oh, great, we have another lead on your car. And next we see them all three in the car, and we learn that they're heading to the Millennium Tower to see Lady True's place. And I'm very excited, was very excited for all the visuals as they were driving up to this place. But the conversation in the car was great as well. Angela asks why Lori and the FBI even give a shit about her car anyway. And Lori says, well, you know, it disappeared the night your chief died, and then it was returned on the night of his funeral, and I don't know, I think it's probably a thermodynamic miracle, which is a sciencey way of saying it's all connected, man.
Yeah.
It's great. Lori also reveals here that she had a chat with Cal earlier, which definitely distresses Angela, and she lets on that she learns that they met in Vietnam. And she learns that Angela's parents were killed, or she says, do you still have family there? And Angela says, no, my parents were killed when I was a kid. And Lori probably already knew this anyway, but then says, oh, an orphan, that makes sense. because, you know, people who fight crime wearing masks usually have some sort of trauma. So clearly that's your trauma.
Right.
And Angela says, you know, what's your trauma? And Lori tells Petey to give the exposition and explain her background, to which she does. And we get all the stuff we already knew about Silk Spectre 2. And I do love that he says, you know, her parents were Silk Spectre and the comedian. They were both in the Minutemen. And and Angela says, oh, like in the TV show. And Petey's like, no, that show's garbage. It's full of historical inaccuracies. Yeah. So he's being, again, this audience surrogate, right, who's this purist, like, oh, no, that's garbage. It's got all these inaccuracies. It's not sticking to the canon.
It's not canon.
Love it. Love, love, love that. It was great.
Yeah, this is a good spot to push in this week's PDpedia files. There were only two this week, and really only one of substance. The second one.
Wait a second. That other one you could define as.
Well, it definitely has some substance, but some relatable content to the show, I guess. Okay. The second one was just a schematic blueprint of a certain adult product that we saw in the last episode, the Dr. Manhattan giant blue dildo. Mm-hmm. But it was a very detailed schematic of how it was built.
Good. And in case anybody wants to replicate it, they can do so.
I did. I sent it to Jeff Lieboff because I figured he'd be interested. Yeah.
Sure.
He said it didn't seem big enough for him.
Ah, okay.
I think it's 14 inches by 6 inch diameter, which is just goddamn enormous.
Well, you know, if you want it bigger, much like a recipe that you're following, if you want to make more, you double
the ingredients. So the other article was an interview transcript. And most of it is redacted, but it's an interview transcript of Lori from a time she was arrested with Dan Dreiberg. It's the last time her and Dan worked together, and Dan is Night Owl.
Right, right.
And it's the interesting kind of just, you know, thing that really doesn't mean anything, but the way they tied into our current or our alternate reality that we're in is they were arrested stopping Timothy McVeigh from the Oklahoma City bombing.
Nice.
And so she even asked, like, when they start asking her questions, she just says, well, did they get McVeigh? Is he alive or dead? And they say that he's dead. And she starts laughing. They're like, do you think it's funny that you're here? She's like, do I think it's funny that I'm arrested for murdering or do you think it's funny you're being arrested for murder? She goes, for murdering a terrorist? Yes, I do think it's funny.
Mm.
So her and Dreiberg stopped Timothy McVeigh, but they were arrested for vigilantism. And so there's kind of some back and forth. You do find out that Dan built the dildo for her as kind of a fuck you to her, because I guess their relationship could never really go anywhere because she was always so hung up on Dr. Manhattan.
Literally.
So it was kind of like, fine, if you need Manhattan, here's Manhattan.
Yeah.
But you do kind of get at the end, Dreiberg is in prison because he refused to talk about anything that happened while they arrested him, and really to talk about anything that had to do with the, I think it's 11-2, the November 2nd event, the squid, from the 80s. But she says, well, let me talk to your boss's boss because I know something about it. And so it sounds like she basically got a plea deal. And also this is why she works for the FBI, because she has talked to whoever the ups are, mm-hmm. and is now kind of in the circle.
That makes sense. I was just about to ask, how does it reveal how she got off of her?
No, it ends with her basically like, let me talk to your boss's boss's boss, because I have information about 11-2.
So I have a hunch that more of that will be revealed in PDpedia files as the weeks move on. So
yeah, and I think I think we mentioned this last week. I think we will eventually either see a flashback or maybe even through Petey on the show, because he kind of seems to be the guy on the show who occasionally will fill in back information. Like, I thought that the whole scene of this car was a way for people who don't know the source material, or maybe who haven't read it in forever, like, hey, if you don't really remember who this Lori Blake person is, let's fill you in about how she's connected to the old Watchmen world. And so that's his way, the way he explains that to Angela. You know, Angela's the new person, and he's now filling in the blanks for the uninitiated into the Watchmen. So
yeah, I love that. This is great. You know, and that makes me think, that made me think, this was two episodes in a row without our American hero story content. And so I hope we get a double dose of it soon.
Yeah, they keep mentioning it, so it's definitely not something they're just forgetting about. But I did find it weird that we're not even seeing, like, a commercial on the background or something, which is kind of how they seemed like they would show it at first. But yeah, I think we'll definitely get it.
I mean, I guess if you're meant to believe it's a weekly show, you know, or
that's true, and everything's happened.
It should be a week goes by before we see our team, our folks watching another episode. But yeah, it seems like a commercial or a trailer or some. We should be getting something.
Yeah.
I hope we get more of it. Anyway. So, yeah, these great visuals as we move into the Millennium Tower and we see the exterior and interior of Lady True's facility. We start off in a big airplane hangar area with these very interesting-looking aircrafts that they establish could pick up a car and drop it. And they learn that this facility has six of them. And Lori asks for a full list of all the pilots who are authorized to fly those who were on duty the night before. And then Lady True's daughter comes in. This is the same one from the newspaper stand in episode 2, who was buying all the newspapers. Cute little girl. She introduces herself as Bien and says Lady True wants to have tea with them in her vivarium. And, well, she does say, you know, normally authorities, Lady True leaves the authorities to the underlings here, but they specifically, she is invited to her vivarium for tea. And Lori says, ooh la la.
Yeah.
And they start to walk off, and BN says, oh no, only the ladies, leaving poor Petey behind.
Yeah, I guess I'll go wait in the car.
Yeah, it was funny. His little rejection there was hilarious. As they're walking to Lady True, Bien explains that they're building, she talks about different structures who crumbled over time or were eliminated by different weather events. And so they say to her, oh, so this is going to be the eighth wonder of the world that you're building here. And Bien says, no, they're building the first wonder of the new world. And then Angela finally says, well, what does it do?
Yeah.
And Bien just says, it tells time.
Right. So this is another spot where, again, the way she's talking about it, it doesn't sound like it's complete yet, right?
Mm-hmm.
So this is another reason why I think the whole farm scene could be happening now, because they do say that you're the one building that clock. So, I mean, technically she's still building it, or they're still finishing it.
Oh yeah. Good.
So,
point.
But I do think this basically, I don't think we need to look any more into the fact that, like, it's definitely, these are one of the ships that took the car, right? Like, this is pretty much the answer to that.
Yes.
And I don't think people should be like, well, are we sure? 'Cause they don't outright say it. I think pretty much you just take it for, it's pretty clear.
The fact that Will is there at the end.
Yeah.
It's for sure.
So we have that answer, which is a pretty big one from two episodes of who took it and who dropped it, right? It definitely is clear that it wasn't Manhattan now that dropped the car.
Right.
You know, and so I think that's a pretty big answer that maybe a lot of people don't even think that they realize that they got.
Yeah, that's true.
So.
Because of so many more questions. With every answer comes five new questions.
Right. And so she also, when she says the first wonder of the new world, again, I take that as a very somewhat ominous saying, you know, like something's going to happen to where we are moving into a new era of the world. And already we've already gotten kind of the vibe. And of course now what we're going to get from True, we continue to get this vibe that she is the Adrian Veidt of the show, of this series, you know, the billionaire that seems to, or trillionaire, I'm sorry, the trillionaire that has massive plans for the world. Right. And she's obviously planning for something, whatever the space junk that flew out of the sky is, she has some importance with, We're going to find out she has some conspiratorial ties with Will. So is she planning a Vite-like, I won't say terrorism because I don't think it was for the purpose of terrorizing the world what he did, but a kind of culling or something like that again? Or is she expecting some kind of disaster to happen to where it's going to shake things up enough to where we refer to it now as the new world, I wonder?
I think so. I think that's a really good, astute prediction there, accurate prediction. Also, I mean, I think she's directly tied with Vite's imprisonment.
Yes.
Yes, so we'll talk about it when we get to the Vite scene. We're almost there, but I do think that they're directly linked, right?
Yes.
There's no doubt.
Yeah.
All right. So meeting Lady True for the first time, and I just love Lady True, by the way. Can't say it enough. And you notice that her costume design, I don't know if this really matters, but she's wearing gloves.
Yes, I did notice. I noticed that in the very first scene.
And she wears them all the way through. She never takes them off, even when she's touching her child.
Everything from her neck down is covered. Like, even her arms are wrapped, you know, all the way to the gloves. Yes, and so I definitely noticed that.
I have to think that because she's all tied, mixed up in this DNA stuff, that she doesn't want any of her DNA getting on things, unauthorized. I have to think it has to do with something like that.
Either anyway. That or she's some kind of robot person.
She's definitely something. But I do love this callback here as True and Angela meet for the first time. And Lori says that Angela's from Vietnam also.
Mm-hmm.
So they learn that they're both from Vietnam, and Angela goes, oh, it's a thermodynamic miracle.
Yeah.
So great. Then they also exchange expressions of grief that they learned when they were children in Vietnam so that they can really secretly speak to each other in Vietnamese, which, by the way, Lori probably knows what they're saying.
I was going to ask you that once you – yeah, I was going to say, do you think she definitely knows Vietnamese?
Probably. They probably teach it in school. Of course, that wouldn't have been taught when Lori was going through school. But she's in the FBI.
She's in the FBI.
Loud, so.
Yeah.
And she's a smart cookie, so yes. But anyway, she doesn't let on if she does know. But what they're really saying is, True says to Angela, wants to know if you Will wants to know if you have his pills. And Angela's response is, tell that old fucker if he wants them, he can come get them himself. It's just hilarious. And then Lori spots a golden statue and says, oh, is that Adrian Vite? And Lady True says yes and confirms that, yes, she did buy his company after he disappeared. And Lori says, why'd you make it so old? And again, Lady True has that quick little snap out of her kindly demeanor. And she says, because he is old.
Yeah.
And then snaps right back into it. And says, in our country, the elderly are revered.
Yeah.
So, yeah, she has disdain for Vite. That statue right there, I think, is the foundation of his imprisonment. Somehow that statue is... This is all going to be very mystically tied together.
I think so, too. I kept having the thought of maybe, like, does the statue... I wonder if it changes over time type of thing. Like, if it's almost like... represents, like, it's like her way of seeing what he's doing, because especially because that's how we left him last episode with him with the costume.
Yeah.
And it's the exact same stance he had and everything.
Yeah.
And so I think that was definitely purposeful. I saw some weird theory that some people think that, you know, because I think a lot of people have kind of taken to this to where, and I think we mentioned this our very first episode about how the whole Vite thing was happening in the past and it's catching up to where we are, that maybe he has at this point come down to Earth and he's actually, that is him somehow trapped in bronze or something, you know, which I don't like that very much, but
no, like Han Solo.
Yeah. Carbonite. But it definitely is representing him right now, not from like he was old 30 years ago type of thing, because he would have been, but like he's an old dude now, and it's definitely intentional that it's the exact same pose that we saw last week, I think.
You think Lori, in all of her infinite wisdom, knows the truth about Veidt's whereabouts and is sitting there, you know, taunting True now and trying to see what she can get True to reveal here of stuff that she already knows?
That I don't know. Now, I don't know if she knows that much about Veidt as far as like what happened to him later. I don't know.
All right. Well, speaking of, we now cut to the Veidt scene of the episode. And just when you thought, Dean, it couldn't get any weirder, it does. It goes there.
You think this is the hunting at midnight he was talking about? Oh,
God. I just don't. Even in my rewatches of this, I thought, I just don't know that I could sit here and watch this again. It was horrible. So, well, we definitely get another answer of where Phillips and Crookshanks come from.
Yep.
So Veidt is in a boat at night. He's fishing. He is pulling underdeveloped baby fetuses out of the pond and throwing ones back in that he doesn't like. We do see that he brings two of those baby fetuses back into his lab and puts them in a large tank, and then he locks them in, puts on some reggae music, begins to eat some cake while we hear them in the background screaming in pain and all kinds of creaking noises and horrible screams. It's clearly quite torturous, but in the end we see they are grown into adult versions. And we have a Phillips and Crookshanks in that tank.
Yes, it's an easy bake oven for clones.
Yeah, so he takes them back to... Did you want to say more about
that? I just find it funny that he is like all into reggae music because he was listening to the Israelites last week and now he's got this reggae song. And I don't remember if he had a reggae thing. It seems like... I don't know if they had that going in the old comic or not, but I do think it's funny that he definitely has a preferred musical genre, and you would think it would be like very classical, you know, Beethoven and stuff. But yeah, he's all into the reggae.
Yeah, man. Don't blame him. So he takes them back to the mansion and is explaining to him that, yes, he is their master, but he's not their maker. He would have never created them to have a life without purpose. And that is what these beings are to him. Their only purpose is to serve him. So he knows that they essentially can't think for themselves. I think this is just why he's so heartless and cruel to them and uncaring and doesn't consider them really fully formed people, which is really pretty terrible.
I think it's also why he gets so frustrated with them. We talked, I had said the other week that I thought maybe he was frustrated at himself because they weren't perfect, but now we realize he's frustrated at whoever they're, whoever the entity that has created this way that they, you know, thrive. And he doesn't like that they're imperfect like that.
Right. And you can see that he, over the ones that we've seen him interact with, he's constantly trying to teach them things that they are not able to grasp. And he's mocking them. Now he's just at the point where he's completely mocking them for it.
Yes.
You know, about how, like, you wouldn't even know how to have an opinion and things like that, you know, that he said to them in the past. So it's, whatever their purpose was, whatever they were given to him in the beginning to be, he is completely mutilated and mangled that because in his mind, he's so scorned against them almost, not scorned, but he's got such disdain for them.
Yeah. And I think he did have, even in the very first episode, I know he gets frustrated with the horseshoe.
Yeah.
But when he gets the watch and everything, he does seem to have some fondness for both of them.
That's true.
And, or at least, you know, he appreciates them. Yeah.
Yeah. And like, oh, maybe they did figure out something and have a purpose other than.
And so, and he does make this clear in a moment, but now that we have found out that he has been at this place for years and he's realized that it is not a place that he wants to be, I think, yes, his frustrations are being taken. And especially now that he's realized that these are just, you know, tadpole people or whatever they are, they don't matter.
But they're still people, right? This is a slippery slope we probably don't want to go down, but I'm sure this was a definitely a Lindelof way of evoking this kind of conversation.
Sure. You know? Well, it's the old you know, android type of thought process from Blade Runner and movies from forever. Once they have consciousness, do they cease to be a thing and become a person? You know, just because it's a machine, if a machine has ultimate artificial intelligence and has feelings, you know, do we treat it like a person at that point, or do we just treat it as a thing still? So this, the same kind of concept with this clone. It's not a natural being, but it is technically, you know, it has consciousness. So do we treat it as a person? Yeah, that's a good way to think about
like
it.
They look like little babies and cry like little babies when he's pulling them out, and he has no thought about them. And I was saying this is more of an even bigger commentary on abortion, is what I drew from it.
Ooh. Oh yeah, let's not go down
like
that road.
Social,
yes.
Social thing. And again, I mean, you know, I don't want to go down that conversation, but that's also how I took it.
Yeah, I can see that. Let's have this conversation. Who do you think's the person that created them?
Lady True, honestly.
Well, it makes sense considering she created this baby at the beginning.
Uh-huh.
But do you think that's how she created? Do you think in her vivarium she's got like a baby pool? And
yeah, I think she's raising one by the name of Bien.
That's true.
I think this is all Lady True's design. I really know
on most theories online, everyone wants to keep going back to when Dr. Manhattan leaves Earth. He does make a comment about, I think I'm going to go try to create life of my own.
Hmm.
And so I think people want to still go back to him maybe having something to do with it. But I definitely, this episode for sure gave me the feeling that Lady True has something to do, if not everything to do, with whatever this captivity is of Bite.
Didn't you and I know that you said it, I can't remember if it was last week or the week before, but we talked about, like, what if Dr. Manhattan's really just a thing that's talked about in this show and shown kind of, you know, in imagery and things, like with the blue pleasuring device. And, you know, he's talked about and mentioned, but never really makes an appearance as a character actually on the show.
But haven't they shown him in previews?
I don't think so.
They've shown one scene where it shows like a blue hand picking up a Dr. Manhattan mask off the street. And then there's another one where it almost looks like he's ordering a drink from a bar or something like that.
That's true.
But of course, I mean, promos don't ever mean anything necessarily. And so
have they I haven't heard anything about a Dr. Manhattan being cast.
I haven't either.
Do you want to know what I heard somebody speculate who the best casting could be? And I 100% agree, would be perfect. Perfect. Yeah, Justin Theroux.
Oh, for sure. Yes.
Well, and that continues the dick joke from The Leftovers. It would be so perfect.
Yeah.
I don't know if he'd do it.
He would be good, because he can play that kind of cold callousness and very easily. I actually thought he did a good enough job in the movie where if they brought back now I can't think of his name off the top of my head. But if they brought back the actor from the movie, he would be. He's older now, but still, he played it well.
He did.
But yeah, I don't know. I think we'll see him at least by the end. But I know that Lindelof talked about him almost as like the old Superman problem where, you know, because Superman is Superman, once you have him, the reason why multiple Superman movies over time just don't make as much sense is because you just can't stop him. He's too unstoppable. Right. So once you bring in God, once you bring in Dr. Manhattan,
there's no conflict.
You leave yourself very little room to keep moving forward.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know.
Exactly right. All right, so back to Vite and his new Phillips and Crookshanks. He takes them into his manor and into the room where we see a bunch of Phillips and Crookshanks have all been murdered, all in a room. Vite says he had a rough night. We do see a cake on the table that has four candles in it. And then he does pry a horseshoe from a dead Phillips hand and says, I don't need it just yet.
Yeah.
And then, so, again, I've heard some conversation about like, oh, well, he must be, you know, making new Phillips and Crookshanks all the time if he's killing them like this. I think this was not, I don't think he's killing them all like this all the time. I think this was I freaked out, I flipped out, I had a bad night, and now I've got to make some more because I done messed up.
Yeah, I kind of thought that too. And when he says I had a bad night, and you said this earlier during this episode, I do think you had something there when you're when we are starting to think, yes, it does seem like an anniversary is a year, but a year might be like an entire day where he is. A days might last that long.
Right.
And so it might have been that he, in four, quote, days or years or whatever it is, he's finally at a snapping point at this point.
It's safe to say that he could be losing the passage of time as well and losing track of it. So, but
these definitely don't seem like the ones that, you know, from the two episodes ago when we first learned that these are clones, that he's killing a couple of them every now and then when he burns the Mr. Right. Phillips, he says, put him in the basement with the others.
Right.
Well, so it did sound like there were definitely other dead ones, but this didn't seem like the basement where he was. And this doesn't seem like a piling of bodies as if they were being burned in a play, right? So this is definitely not what he had been talking about.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think that he did not mean to do this, and now, and also I don't think he gets any pleasure or joy in growing those babies in that machine. I think that's why he plays the reggae music so loud and refuses to look at them, because he was holding his hand in his head in his hand. You know, he was, because the noises are horrible. It's awful. So he clearly doesn't enjoy growing them.
Right. It's to him, it's just Bite has always been the person of pure, him and Dr. Manhattan, which is why they always kind of were the closest thing to peers. They are the ones who see the world as cost-benefit analysis almost 100% of the time. So to him, it's just, you know, as long as the ends justify the means, it might be horrible that he has to, whatever these things are, hurt them or, you know, cause them pain. But in the end, if it gets him to what's going to ultimately be his goal, it's just, it's a necessary evil type of thing.
I guess it's hard to say, because he does seem to have a use for the dead bodies, which he does remark in the next season, how that's helping him achieve his goal. But I also just, what I was saying is, I don't think that he would kill so many all at once and then have to go through the extreme torture that he hates, clearly, of having to make so many more.
Right.
So maybe he killed them all with his plan to only make two more, and those are the two that are helping, and maybe this is end game here that we're
possibly
seeing.
Do you do you think the horseshoe will eventually have significance?
I do. I don't know how, but again, that could be one of those things that it's like, oh yeah, and the horseshoe.
Well, because it seemed like if they would have never mentioned it again, it was just kind of a funny way to show that there was something wrong with these clones.
Right.
But now for it to seemingly be something that continuously happens, and for him to still, like, the way he kind of says, not just yet, like, it seems like there is a point where he will need a horseshoe for some reason. So I think there might be something there, or else why keep bringing it back? Maybe this is the, you know, to link it to the joke from last episode, it doesn't necessarily have to do with Lori, but maybe this horseshoe might be one of those bricks being thrown up in the air that we're not supposed to forget about.
Nice. Nice. All right. Remember the horseshoe. That'll be our new slogan. We'll get it on our Mike TV shirts.
There you go.
Remember the horseshoe. All right. Somebody make those for us. All right. So we're talking to you, Roby. We got an email from Roby. We'll get to that too at the end. All right. So the next scene is, I just love it. They're bringing the dead bodies to this big catapult thing and launching them into the sky. And as they launch each one, Vite is watching through a telescope, and we can see the body go up into the sky and then just kind of disappear, like it's blipping out of the atmosphere or going into another dimension, is definitely what it looks like. And at this point, Vite is talking with his new Phillips and Crookshanks, and he says it's been 4 years since he's been sent here, and in the beginning he thought it was a paradise. But it's not. It's just a prison. And he says that your lives and your bodies, your mangled bodies, one way or another, with the help of them, I will escape this godforsaken place. And they continue to catapult these bodies. And he is acting like this is some sort of victory.
Right.
So what do you think the hell is happening here?
I definitely think wherever he's trapped, he is in some sort of dome or bubble, you know, like it's mm-hmm. it's more of he's looking for the boundaries of where he is, I think. And we talked about this last week with the suit that he was making. He's definitely probably somewhere in space, whether it's Mars or the moon or something, but I think he is in some kind of, if he leaves this, he's going to have to need a space suit of some sort.
It's like he's given up on the space suit and moved to Catapult, or do you think he's been building these suits?
I think they go hand in hand. Okay. He's going to need the space suit to,
Well, he didn't catapult Phillips in the spacesuit in the last episode.
We didn't see him. He was tying the rope to him, and then it cuts to him frozen.
That's right.
So I think he definitely did catapult him into the air.
You're right.
I think he's looking for the parameters or the boundaries maybe of, or maybe even there's a specific point, like an exit point. You know, so maybe that's what it is.
Mm.
Maybe there's only one spot that you can exit.
He's trying to find it.
Yeah,
and so maybe that's
what it is too. He's okay. Found the hole.
Okay, I like it.
Yeah, and it definitely for him to say that I thought this was paradise, but now I realize it's prison. Last week we got the letter from the game warden, and in the letter it says you agreed to these terms of captivity. So I think he wasn't necessarily forced to this place. I mean, he kind of was, but it was mm-hmm. almost like maybe he was given a choice of one thing or another, and he decided, whoever he made this deal with, that okay, instead of, you know, it's almost like exile, like Napoleon style, you'll get exiled to this place, and you can, maybe they made decisions on, he gets these servants that he can grow, he has certain technologies at his disposal, he's got his castle, he gets, you know, he demands a record player with unlimited reggae records, whatever. And so, again, at first he thought it was paradise.
A tree that can grow tomatoes.
Yeah, sure. So
I think the game warden is Lady True. I think she could somehow find, she knows how to be able to, like, watch him and step in when she needs to.
Well, I don't think it's Lady True herself. I think it's, like, maybe an agent of hers. Because he had a mustache.
Oh, yeah. Well, okay, so interesting, too, we do get the transition scene leaving Veidt and going back to Angela's house, and this is a transition scene through a moon. So as it pans out from Veidt's, then we see the moon hanging over Oklahoma. So this is where I was like, oh, okay, he's on the moon.
Yeah.
Time passes differently on the moon than Earth, but I'm no scientist, so I don't know the differences there, the variances, but could he somehow be on the moon? Could this be happening?
I mean, he could somehow be anywhere. This is the Watchmen. If there's a lube man, there can be a moon man. So,
all right. So Angela, goes into her house. She sees Cal, asks what he's reading, and he's reading a book called Things Fall Apart. And, again, this is out there. We're not the first to report on this, but Things Fall Apart is an actual book. It is written by an author whose name I cannot pronounce. I believe he is Norwegian. No. Anyway, I already forgot his ethnicity, too, so I'm truly terrible. But there is a quote in Things Fall Apart, specifically, if you don't like my story, write your own. Is an exact quote from that book. So again, this is a nice little callback to our title of this episode. Anyway, Angela asks Cal, when were you going to tell me the FBI lady came by? And I love his remark. His response is, oh yeah, the FBI lady came by. And so she says, well, what did you all talk about? And, he says she wanted to know who called the house the night of Cal's murder, and she must have checked the phone records to know we've got a call that night. And then Cal gives Angela the real story of what, of course, we know happened, and she sits down and says, you didn't really say all that to her. And he says, no, I lie. And she says, well, and you hate lying. Yeah, we learn he hates lying. I don't know if that's a thing. Angela says, well, she knew that we met in Vietnam. So did you tell her about your accident?
Dun, dun, dun.
Cal says, no, I didn't tell her about that. It didn't come up. And Angela seems relieved about that. So a little mystery there about Cal. And Cal says, this is where he does say, you know, I feel like Lori wants to help you and wants to help you find the old man. And Angela is defiant and stubborn, says she can find him all by herself. And then she says, let's go meet in the closet, which we also learn is their sex place. So, he hates lying. Doesn't Dr. Manhattan also hate lying? Isn't that a thing?
I think just Manhattan doesn't see the point in lying. I don't necessarily think he hates it. He just says everything as is because there's no point in lying.
Interesting. And also about his accident.
That's always ominous.
Yeah. What do you think it is?
I don't know. Maybe he had a bicycle accident in Hanoi. Simple. It's just a throwaway line. No, certainly it's something, right?
No, it was something because she clearly didn't want Lori to know about it. And, well, anyway.
I think we'll learn more. I think this scene mainly was, again, a way to kind of lay out to Angela that perhaps you're being a little irrational with everything you're doing because everything you're doing is getting more and more illegal. You broke into the cultural center. You're destroying evidence and throwing it away. You know, and he says, maybe she's just trying to help you. Like maybe you should just talk to her and tell her the truth. So Cal's got that same frustration of, I've seen too many shows where people don't talk to each other.
Yeah, he's the audience surrogate there. Just like, come on, get it, you know, get on the same team here, which is what the audience is wanting to. All right, our final scene. Bien awakes from a dream. She unplugs her IV. So she's sleeping with hooked up to an IV. Interesting. She goes to find her mother, and when she does, she tells her about this nightmare that she had where she was in a village and a bunch of men came and burned the village. And she was made to walk and walk and walk for so long that even now, even awake, her feet still hurt. Lady True's face, while Bien is telling all of this, is very distraught. But in the end, she just takes Bien's face in her hands and says, good. And then when Bien says, walk me back to bed, Lady True says, no, my love. And Bien just says, okay, and leaves and says, good night, Mr. Reeves, as she leaves, and the camera pans over to reveal Will is sitting there. So before we move into the Will stuff, don't you think, let's talk about this Bien and this nightmare. This sounded definitely like something out of a Vietnamese village. Definitely seemed like a Lady True memory.
Yeah, she's definitely a clone, right?
Yeah, I think so. Because even the conversation she and Will have, and he kind of throws that back in her face. So it was, she's showing her love, but also emotionless love. And this girl clearly is fine with that because she was, you know, walk me back to bed. No, but she says it sweetly. And so the girl, so Bien is just like, okay.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm sure it's purposeful, but I get it as a parent. There's times when I'll have, you know, the second time the kid comes down the stairs for something that they didn't really need, but then, you know, they just want you to walk. And it's like, at this point, just go back to bed. You're fine. You've already gotten kissed goodnight. Go back to bed.
I don't think this is that scenario.
It's like, stop asking for a cup of water is all I'm saying.
And planting your trauma, your traumatic memories into their dreams. Like, Lady True also does seem like good, like something's working the way she intended it. So, yeah, okay. So, Bien leaves, and Will is there. Oh, my God, Will is sitting there. Big reveal here, right?
So yeah, Lady True's very refreshed looking, too.
Yeah, not quite so old and feeble. So, Lady True sits down, says, where were we? She starts to pour them some tea, and she says to him, why don't you just tell her who you are? So, you know, they're talking about Angela. And Will says, well, she has to experience it for herself. And Lady True says, well, isn't that just a little too cute? And he says, isn't that what you're doing with your daughter? That really shuts her down, too. Mm-hmm. So then Lady True starts to go on about how she's worried about him backing out because families are involved now. And, you know, sometimes that muddies the water. And then he stands up and says how he stands up. I guess that's important. She makes something about, like, we have to be firm footed on this, or, you know, on the same, you know, on the same page or something about, she makes some remark about feet, and he stands up and says, my feet are just fine. Mm-hmm. And he begins to walk and says, how long do we have? And she says, 3 days. And then he says, well, in 3 days, she will know what I have done and she will hate me for it. So if you're concerned whether or not I'm in, well, I'm all the way in. Tick tock, tick tock. And we get the end credits to a beautiful version of Time Is On My Side.
Yeah.
Love that.
And are they both looking, right. They both are like looking up into the sky at this point, right? Or are they looking up at the millennial clock at this
Yeah,
point?
They're looking up. They're looking up. We do get this kind of overhead view of the Millennium Clock, and it's quite impressive looking. Who knows what they're going to do in 3 days? I have a feeling it's directly tied in with Veidt's big escape, though.
Yeah.
It's all going to come crashing in.
I also think I think this is going to be some event, too, that's maybe they're trying to draw Manhattan back to Earth or something.
Maybe, but why?
I don't know, but she's, because the Manhattan phone booths, they were ran by True Industries, and so, I don't know, it's all going to be connected.
If those are even, those transmissions are even getting to Dr. Manhattan, again, that could just be True's way of listening in to people wanting to talk to Dr. Manhattan to figure out why.
Right.
Lady True definitely strikes me as power hungry. She wants to, I don't think she'd want to share the spotlight with Manhattan. I think she wants to fool the world in thinking that she's got everything under control. We don't need Veidt. We don't need Manhattan.
Right. And yeah, I don't know. So Will definitely does not look nearly as old here. He doesn't even have his gray hair. Like, he had gray hair on the sides. This one, he's bald completely. He's
That's true.
Looks way younger. Like, they did his makeup and everything, so he doesn't look like an old man, you know. And, of course, obviously, he's standing up. So, do you think it was, and I'm assuming it wasn't like, you know, he had a fake wig on or something and all this stuff. So do you think he has some kind of powers, or do you think that maybe there's a way that she has some kind of way to rejuvenate him, or he has a way to rejuvenate, like a medically type of thing?
Mm-hmm. I think, yeah. And maybe those pills are tied to it, or maybe.
I kind of thought that if maybe the pills, if he takes them, if they keep him older type of thing.
Mm.
And so I don't know.
Could be. To keep up the disguise?
Yeah, yeah. So I don't know. Mm. It's weird. Definitely weird.
So, all right. Let's go to our email from Roby, shall we? I think we've talked about a lot of these, but he had some great questions here.
Yeah, I got a bone to pick. Yeah, I got a bone to pick with Roby, too.
Oh, no. Not Roby. Why?
It's not because we have a disagreement about something that we talked about from
That's
last time.
That's right. I saw the Twitter feud. All right. Well, let's go through his questions and then you could address that. And Roby, please chime in and keep the conversation going, Roby. And oh, by the way, everybody, you can email us too at miktvpodcast@gmail.com. That's miktvpodcast@gmail.com. Please, please drop us a line. We want to hear what you're watching other than Watchmen, what you'd like us to watch, what you'd like us to talk about. And, of course, like Roby has done here, send us your Watchmen thoughts. We will read them on the air. So he asks, did Lori go back and get her acorn? I don't know, Roby. I think once it goes down that chute and makes the hologram tree, I don't think the acorn gets returned as a keepsake. What do you think?
Yeah, no, he'd probably just go back to the kiosk and get another one.
Yeah, yeah. He says, it sucks and is great in every single word, that every single word and frame is either an Easter egg or a clue.
Or a literal egg.
I think it sucks. I think it is great. I think it's great that it rewards people to pay attention to this show. You're right, Roby. Every word or frame is a clue. 100% there.
I think you get the most out of this show, and I think even we probably miss a lot because we weren't hardcore, or even readers of the original source material. I know we both looked into it a lot, but I think if you really read this, you would, and you are open to a new Watchmen concept, you are going to enjoy it. I think also if you're diving into the PDPedia stuff and following along with our podcast or Watchmen Watch or the official Watchmen or the plethora of other podcasts out there, this is one of those where you have fun trying to unravel the mystery. It's one where you want to go online and find a discussion board of people throwing theories around. This makes me feel like I felt when I watched Lost, especially for the first like 3 or 4 seasons, where everybody's just throwing wild theories every week, and then every week you realize half of them are wrong and you come up with new ones.
So, but in terms of Watchmen, we won't name any names, but let's just say those on our sister podcast, or I should say our parent podcast, who say this show is slow paced. What the hell are they talking about, Dean? There's nothing slow about this show at all.
I really don't find it slow.
I don't find it slow at all. I find it wildly crazy fast.
Even when I find it slow, it's almost more like, oh, wait, there's still more show left? Great. Mm-hmm. Like, I keep thinking it's already over, but then it's, oh, there's still, like, another big scene left.
Yeah.
And I think almost every episode, this might have been the first episode that didn't have, like, one really good action scene, too. Like, the only kind of action scene in this one was the lube man chase.
Chase, right.
But there's, in almost every other episode, there's at least been, like, an awesome fight or the funeral scene from last episode with the explosion and everything. So, I mean, this isn't a sit down for a weekend and binge your show type of thing. You've got to be into it. Like, you want to wait till the next week and anticipate it. And I know that's hard for a lot of people now because we're just getting deprogrammed from old school television concept.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. As soon as we get done here, I'm about to go binge watch The Crown. So yeah, I know. Week-to-week shows are hard for people. I get it. It's hard to retain that kind of content from one week to the next. You need podcasts. Yeah, you need supplemental material. You need to email at miketvpodcast @gmail.com and have conversations about it. That's the way this show stays top of mind.
Yeah, and you got to remember, this isn't TV. It's HBO.
That's right. All right, so Roby goes on to say, hey, the FBI partner is the right build for the lube guy. Yeah, Roby, I think we all caught that one. I agree. He says, what's with the damn horseshoe?
There we go. Pay attention to the horseshoe.
That, yep. I think it's the brick. I think Dean's right. It's the brick. Lady True sounds and has mannerisms just like Lucy Liu. I don't know about that one. Is that a little bit there?
No, I could see her playing that like the way. I see why he would pick her specifically, but I could see her, especially if you think of kind of how her character was in Kill Bill.
Yeah.
Definitely that kind of, especially the scene when you first meet her where she's sitting at the table with all the other mob bosses and she starts speaking English and she has that very polite demeanor. But again, you have that, you feel that badness behind her. I can see that.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, I think Lady True, this was a great introduction to her, and it was, I'm off of Roby's email for just a minute here, but, I don't know. She was a fully formed character. I think she's fully unique. I don't hearken her to be like anybody else. I'm so excited for this character and to see more of her. But Roby ends his email with, is True's daughter is a clone of True, and based on her apparent age, is True's, or are the clone's memories from the Vietnam War?
Yeah, I think we definitely talked about that.
I think Roby is spot on with those thoughts.
I'll tell you what he's not spot on, though.
Uh-oh.
That skin that was being harvested for the spacesuit last week was definitely pig skin.
Okay.
Roby insists that it's clone skin, but if you go back and look, I posted a picture on Twitter You clearly see pigs drying out in the courtyard. Yeah. And when you see the hides all stretched out, they can't be a human skin. They even have little like feet spots for where the pig feet would be. So I'm sticking with that.
This week on The Walking Dead, the Whisperers were harvesting some skin too. So Roby,
that show's still on the air?
Yes. Oh. It's good. So Roby, you can definitely catch some zombie skin harvesting over on The Walking Dead. I'm definitely leaning with you, Dean, on this one, and thank you for both of your detective work on this. I think I could also meet in the middle and say it's probably fair to assume that throughout his 4 years of running experiments, he's probably harvested both pig and Phillips and Crookshanks skins.
Yeah, okay, I'll meet in the middle.
Okay, well, yay, we did it, we did it. So just looks like our next episode is, which we are going to do our best to get this one out before the next episode airs. I'm going to send it over to Tim as soon as we get off here. It looks like we're going to get a great LG backstory. I can't wait for that.
Yes, I was somewhat not upset, but I did kind of hope that this episode, especially when we first saw Lady True, and I guess it did follow her more than other characters, but I was hoping it would be a little bit more centric from her point of view, because I liked how we started seeing that shift last week with Lori. And sure. We talked about how this is kind of a Lindelof thing where he does like doing character centric episodes.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm kind of hoping we're going to get that next week with LG, because mm-hmm. I really want to know more about him. And again, Tim Blake Nelson is crushing this season.
So I have, I 100% agree. And I'm excited for that episode too. And I have a thought. That's what I was thinking too, is he's studying these squids. I somehow think Lady True is behind the squid showers. Also, I mean, I think it's all just Lady True. I'm just putting it all on her.
PDPedia files mention that the squid showers have been happening ever since the squid attack.
Right.
So she may be keeping it up, because I think since she did buy Vite, I mean, I think she knows everything about Vite, obviously. So she might continue some of the conspiracy stuff that he already had laid down.
Right.
But I think it's something that's been going on for
the way
a while.
LG. So yeah, but the way LG spoke about these squid, how they, you know, are struggling for life in their, you know, their 15 minutes of life or whatever, is spent, you know, dying in agonizing pain. I just somehow relate it to this pond of fetus
pain. Yeah.
And so I think that somehow, I don't know, could the catapulting mechanism somehow with those bodies going into, you know, like our atmosphere, presumably, could that be somehow tied to these squid showers? I mean, this is out there, right? But could it somehow be all mixed in together?
Maybe that meteorite we saw crashing down at the beginning was just Mrs. Crookshanks' body catapulting into the earth.
Yes. So, and the other thing I have heard is that episode 6, so this was episode 4 that we just covered, 5 is going to be the LG backstory. And then what I've heard from people who've gotten some screeners and not spoiled anything, these are, you know, professional people, reporters and such that I've read online, or heard or read, that episode 6 is supposed to be the one that's like the holy shit, oh my God episode. So we're coming into the end of the second arc. 4, 5, and 6 complete the second arc. So of course that's when Lindelof's going to release another podcast too. But I think 6, this episode 5 is going to be great, but 6 is just going to blow our freaking minds is what I've heard. So I'm ready.
Cool.
All right. Let's, anything else to say? You want to wrap up and throw our Twitter information out there?
Yeah. Follow us on Twitter at MikeTV1. And send us any questions or thoughts on this week's episode or next week's episode or anything you want us to discuss, or of course about any other show. If you want to hear us talk about it or at least mention it, we will. Follow me on Twitter at Rockdale_Tiger. And if you want to talk about this show or any other show, or if you want to chat college football as we get toward the playoff season, please do. And you can always find me living rent-free in Tim Andrews' head on Radio Labyrinth podcast every week as well. Apparently, I'm like becoming the fifth host that's never actually there, because I'm getting more and more airtime every week. Nice. So I will continue to troll Tim.
Mm-hmm.
And get my name out there.
Yes. One thing we will promise you that we will continue to be thorough. Very, very thorough.
Yes, and catch our 17-hour American Horror Story coverage coming soon.
I don't know, the way that one ended.
Actually, I was about to say, maybe a 17-second of I'll just do in living color. Hated it.
Yeah. It was kind of not so great. But, you know, hey, it's I'm glad we chose not to cover it. There wouldn't have been much meat on the bones there. But
that's
I do
right.
want us
We're
to
gonna...
try to do here's one thing, and maybe we'll say this starting at the top of our episodes going forward. But we want to try to do like our best of top 10 shows of the year, you know, as 2019 comes to an end, like every podcast in the world that covers TV isn't going to be doing this, but
yeah, what's the
we're
going to
do it too.
What's the schedule for Watchmen? When's the 9th episode supposed to, are they going to take a Christmas break or anything?
I doubt it. Okay. I think they're going to run all the way through. I've not seen the full schedule, so we'll find that out before our next one, but we'll work out our schedule, but we'd love to hear, dear fans, dear listeners, what your top shows were, and we'll compile our own lists and we'll compare and we'll fight and discuss over why we think we're right and why Succession is 100% going to be on my list.
Yeah, we'll definitely have an end of the year special where we'll wrap up 2019 and also talk about what we're looking forward to in 2020.
Oh yeah, Westworld.
Oh yes, absolutely. All right, well, another week, another Watchmen episode down.
Thanks for being thorough. It's my new sign off. Keep it thorough. Bye.
All right, bye,
thanks.
Lisa.
Bye, Dean. Thanks. That is what we are. No one.